From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, cops and killers. First, drawing the line on where insanity begins, we hear from forensic psychologist Barbara Kerwin, who has examined Joel Rifkin, the Long Island serial killer, and hundreds of other murderers. She says the insanity defense, as controversial as it is, still has a place in our courtroom. Then journalist Mike McAlary, who reports on police corruption in New York. He's written a novelization of the new movie Copland, which opens this month. And we hear some early recordings of William Burroughs reading his work. The influential writer died this weekend at the age of 83. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has ruled out any federal intervention in the Teamsters strike against United Parcel Service.
I still think the parties ought to go back to the table. UPS is a very important company to our country, and there are a lot of employees there, and I hope they'll go back to the table. But at this time, I don't think any further action by me is appropriate.
The White House had already sought the intervention of a federal mediator in talks between the union and the parcel delivery company. Pickets are up across the country. The dispute is over pay, pension, and more full-time jobs. Two Teamsters union members have been arrested on picket lines in Chicago for disorderly conduct. Police say the pickets were allegedly blocking truck traffic in and out of a UPS facility. Israeli soldiers arrested 29 Palestinians in the West Bank today. 145 Palestinians are now in custody following the bombings last week in a Jerusalem market that killed 15 people, including two suicide bombers. The Israeli army says today's suspects may have engaged in, quote, hostile terrorist activity. Israel has also strengthened security in major cities and along the border with the West Bank and Gaza. There was a drive-by shooting in the West Bank yesterday that heightened tension. News reports indicate that Israeli extremists may be responsible for the murder of a Palestinian. Mexican police say six people were killed when gunmen entered a popular restaurant just across the border from El Paso, Texas, and began shooting. Three people were wounded. Frank Contreras reports.
Mexican police are combing Maxim's restaurant in Ciudad Juarez, where the murder spree occurred last night around 9 o'clock. They say that the violence is part of an increasing number of murders in the area, apparently related to drug trafficking. Police say several bodies have been found in the Juarez area in recent weeks, shot to death execution style. Investigators say the latest murders are apparently part of a turf battle among low and mid-level drug traffickers vying for control of cocaine distribution routes. This following the July 4th death of Amado Carrillo Fuentes, one of Mexico's most notorious drug cartel leaders. Several other murders connected to drug trafficking have been reported around the country in recent days. For National Public Radio, this is Frank Contreras in Mexico City.
Firefighters in Southern California are battling six blazes that have burned more than 1,300 acres over the weekend. A spokeswoman for the California Department of Forestry says the biggest blaze is in San Diego County, and it could be fully contained by this evening. The oldest living person in the world died today. Jean Calment died in a retirement home in southern France. She was 122. Calment said she enjoyed her birthdays because it was a chance to eat some chocolate and drink a little sweet wine. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 11 points at 8,183. Trading is active. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed this hour on concern over rising interest rates. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner has more.
Long-term interest rates are higher today on the perception the economy may be picking up steam. However, the concern about rising rates is being met with strength in semiconductor issues, which have rallied for the fourth straight session. Shares in Federal Express and Airborne Freight have advanced. Analysts say the strike against United Parcel Service has given its competitors an opportunity to grab market share. Among the day's losers is General Motors, which is down even though the company announced plans to buy back its stock for the second time this year. The latest repurchase will total $2.5 billion. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government reports spending on new construction fell in June. That's the lowest report in 6 months. The Commerce Department says construction was $591 billion, and economists were looking for an increase. The drop was due to decreases in non-residential commercial construction. Bethlehem Steel says it will sell 2 unprofitable units. The steelmaker has been struggling for a year to restructure its operations. Officials also say efforts to find a buyer for a third unit have broken off. The Beth Steel says it sold Centec and Beth Forge, 2 units that made large steel objects like turbines for heavy industrial use. The third unit up for sale is Beth Ship, a Baltimore shipyard that began in the 1920s. 900 workers were employed there, but Beth Steel began to lay them off in March. About 100 workers are still there. Again on Wall Street, the Dow was down 11 points at 8,183 in active trading. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 160 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen in for Terry Gross. My guest, Barbara Kerwin, is one of New York State's leading experts on the insanity defense. As a forensic psychologist, she's often called in to determine if accused criminals are truly insane according to the very strict legal definition. The concept of legal insanity is widely misunderstood and, Kerwin believes, misused. She came up with the term designer defense for cases where defense attorneys use pleas of temporary insanity due to eating Twinkies and other such far-fetched causes. Barbara Kerwin has a new book out called The Mad, the Bad, and the Innocent. She tells of some of the most high-profile cases she's worked on, including Joel Rifkin, the Long Island serial killer who strangled 17 women, and Dennis Sweeney, who shot Congressman Allard Lowenstein. I asked Kerwin to clarify for us exactly what is at the core of the insanity defense.
At the core of the insanity defense is a notion of free will, or an unencumbered, unimpaired ability of the individual to exercise choice. And there is a sense that when a person is either a child or impaired by mental illness or organic brain damage, which limits their ability to make a free and informed choice, they are therefore not capable of criminal responsibility.
Well, I think it's an area that many people do not understand. And I think we should stay here just a little bit longer to try to help people understand it. I get confused myself, and I've talked about this before. If you're talking about mental illness from a psychiatric point of view, you're talking about something like schizophrenia or some disturbance which really disconnects someone from reality.
Yes.
If you're talking about legal insanity, what are you then referring to? How does the law then describe that mental state?
Well, when you make the leap in logic between a psychiatric diagnosis of mental illness and the legal diagnosis, mental illness is a necessary but not sufficient precondition, because you have to have a specific severity and pervasiveness of that mental illness such that it, in the words of a McNaughton-like statute, interferes with the individual's ability to know and appreciate the nature and consequences of their actions and their wrongfulness. So that, in fact, and I have been on many cases of criminal defendants, where the individual does suffer from a very severe and long-standing and pervasive diagnosable mental illness, but their actions still indicated that they were angry, they had a motivation for the crime, they knew what they were doing, their intent was to harm somebody, and they tried to get away with it. They tried to elude the authorities. And in that situation, you have mental illness, but you do not have legal insanity. You have a mentally ill individual who is criminally responsible.
How often is the insanity defense actually used?
Well, the insanity defense is used very rarely compared to what the public perception is. When I was researching the book, I discovered that when they polled the general population, there was an estimate that people overestimated the use of the insanity defense by about 800%. And when they polled college students, it went up to 900%.
Is that because of high-profile cases?
Precisely. It's because of high-profile cases, and it's because that the insanity defense and the types of crimes in which it's invoked really lend themselves to a tremendous emotionality, something approaching hysteria. So it's a very easy kind of political catch-all, and it can be used to inflame the population and to incite all kinds of thinking about violent crime and reforms in the judicial system. So it really jumps out at us in boldface, and it causes us to, in a very fearful way, feel people are running around and getting away with murder in large numbers. In actuality, so-called normal defendants have a better chance of getting off.
Meaning that the insanity defense doesn't work that often?
No, it does. It's not used that often. I think it's estimated that it's used in less than 1% of the homicide cases in the United States. And it's very rarely effective. Unfortunately, when it is effective, in my opinion, is sometimes in the worst cases, like the cases of women killing their children, or in the cases where you clearly have a criminal or a psychopathic or, if you will, bad defendant who has successfully convinced the jury that he is, in fact, mad and not responsible.
Do you think a jury understands the insanity defense when it's used correctly?
Absolutely not. I have never in 20 years been in front of a jury that I felt really understood the nuances either of mental illness or of how mental illness impacted on the crime at hand or the defendant's responsibility for that crime.
Well, I would think for every expert psychologist, forensic psychologist that the defense has will say, there's another one for the prosecution, and oftentimes offering very contradictory analysis of the defendant.
Absolutely. You have the classic battle of the experts, and I think that that's what wherein some of the problem lies, is that, and I know for sure, because I have been outside of courtrooms talking to experts on the other side of the case, and I know that if we were in a clinic or in a consulting room, we would agree totally on the diagnosis for this individual. But the moment that we are retained by either side, and the moment that we enter a courtroom and we have to defend and support an opinion that is sympathetic to the side which is retaining us, something changes. And then what the public sees is a spectacle that does not engender respect for the profession, because what they say to themselves on the jury is, how can five doctors come in and say this guy is crazy, and then five doctors come in and say he's perfectly sane? So the legitimate conclusion is the doctors are crazy and we really can't believe what they say. And in point of fact, research shows that a lot of times the jury simply throws out the opinion of both sides of experts and simply looks at the person. And if in some subjective way the defendant looks, quote unquote, crazy to them, they will acquit.
If someone is found not guilty by reason of insanity, are they free to go home?
Another big misconception, a very closely guarded trade secret that I have had prosecutors stop trials and object to my testimony rather than let a jury know that. No, in fact, an insanity acquittee never is given cab fare and walks right back out onto the street.
Where do they go?
They go to maximum security mental health hospitals that are run by the various states. There are very, very clearly specified statutes governing their progression through this secure mental health system that where they are evaluated. And then we kick over into another area of the law, generally, at least in New York State, under the criminal proceedings law, which has to do with the determination of dangerous mental illness. they remain in a secure mental health facility until such time that they are, in fact, cured of their mental illness such that they no longer represent a threat to the public safety or the community well-being.
Is it possible, then, for someone to be found not guilty by reason of insanity and actually spend more time behind bars, so to speak, than someone that might be found guilty of first-degree murder?
It's not only possible, it's probable. It is the general case. In studies conducted throughout all of the states in the union, we find that on the average, they wind up spending something like twice as long. And of course, they're not eligible for parole. There is no parole for madness.
My guest on Fresh Air today is Barbara Kerwin. She is a forensic psychologist and the author of The Mad, the Bad, and the Innocent, and it's a look at the insanity defense. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barbara Kerwin, and we're talking about the work she does. She's a forensic psychologist, the author of a new book called The Mad, the Bad, and the Innocent. I want to talk about some of the cases that you've been involved in that you detail in your book. You evaluated the serial killer Joel Rifkin, and he was actually confessed to strangling 17 women in the New York area. When were you called in on that case?
I was called in on that case prior to the trial, when it became apparent that the only defense this individual had was an insanity defense. He was apprehended with a five-day-old decomposing body in the trunk of his car, and he confessed while waiting for his attorney to arrive on the promise of a tuna fish sandwich. So short of taking a plea to guilty, this was the only chance at a defense that this defendant had.
Describe your first meeting with him, what he looked like when you first sat down together.
The word that comes to my mind, and it's not a very elegant one, is he looked like a schlub. Mm. He was had a very hangdog look. Certainly someone you would never in a million years see as menacing or evil or even someone you wouldn't see as insane or psychotic. He looked like someone down on his luck.
Tell us then about Joel Rifkin and the kind of psychological portrait you were able to create for him.
The psychological portrait of Joel Rifkin was a very kind of nebulous and very fragmented profile. When I first heard about his case on the news, I assumed I would be called in by the prosecutors because most of the time that is the side that I can support. I was rather surprised when I was called in by the defense. And I said to them, I will examine him, but most likely, from what I'm hearing on the news media, we have a Dahmer-esque sexual sadist here.
And Dahmer-esque, you mean someone who knew what they were doing and on a kind of a rampage?
Who knew what they were doing, who achieved sexual gratification through these horrible acts, and who mindlessly went on and gratified their perverted impulses at the expense of these young women's lives.
So you went in with that feeling for him?
I went in with that feeling, but I also went in with the knowledge that I can't trust what I'm reading in the media sources, that I don't know what I've got until I look at this person face to face, until I talk to them, and until I give them tests and score those tests and compare them. So I went in with an open mind, but a belief that when it all boiled down, I was going to have a sexual sadist on my hand. I was going to have someone who, although not normal, clearly was not mentally ill and probably not insane, in that they knew what they were doing and they chose this as their outlet for sexual gratification.
Yeah, what did you find instead?
What I found instead, and I wasn't prepared to find this, was a very, very disordered, very psychotic, although very bright and sensitive man. Not even your classic kind of paranoid schizophrenic, because Rifkin's delusions were not well articulated. Rifkin would just shrug his shoulders and say, I don't know why I did it. I don't know.
And you felt in this case that he met the definition then of legal insanity.
Again, I'm going to be careful, because that is really up to the judge and the jury, the triers of fact. But what I felt was that this was someone who genuinely suffered from a severe and pervasive mental illness, and that his schizophrenia had predated the crimes by most of his life, and that it had not been successfully medicated or treated, and that I saw signs in his thinking and in his ability to deal with reality events and people that I felt really precluded his ability to know what he was doing was in fact happening and was in fact wrong. I mean, there were many times when he took a corpse to Burger King, or he felt he was speaking to that person on the telephone after the murder. So this was not someone who, at some fundamental level, as incredible as that is to believe, really knew that when you strangled somebody, they didn't get up and walk 5 minutes later.
Well, the jury didn't buy it. I mean, they didn't buy his defense, and by that I mean they found him guilty, and that they believed that he understood what he did. Where is Joel Rifkin today?
I don't know specifically. He must be somewhere within the New York State correctional system. I believe he still has either trials or he has to take pleas in other jurisdictions, other counties within New York State.
Let me ask you about another case, and this is a case of a young woman named Stephanie Wernick. This is back in 1990. She was a 20-year-old student at a local college. She gave birth to a baby in a dorm bathroom. I believe a custodian found a baby boy found in the garbage bag, and obviously reads ominously like some recent events that we've been reading about in the newspapers. When were you called in to evaluate Stephanie Wernick?
I was called in again at the point in which her defense attorney entered an insanity defense. And Wernick was kind of a turning point case for me, because I had gotten tired of what I saw as a kind of deterioration in the standards of insanity defense work in the courts. I felt very disgusted with some of the experts and some of the shenanigans that were permitted to go on in the courtroom. And I had kind of called myself retired. And I received a telephone call from George Peck, who later on became the prosecutor on the Colin Ferguson Long Island Railroad Massacre case. And I said, George, you know, I'm sort of in retirement here. And he said, maybe you'll think twice about it when I explain the case to you. I think that this is a very, very important case for you, and I think we need your expertise and your opinion. And it certainly was. And it became a turning point, not only because of the, you know, really unfortunate nature of the crime, but also because it was the first time that I walked into the courtroom to stare into a rack of floodlights and video cameras.
Because of how high profile it was?
Because of how high profile, and the fact that the media, with the proliferation of cable networks and so on, was starting to discover the appeal of insanity defense crimes.
Now, her defense team used the insanity defense. Did it work?
No, it did not work, and that was really a surprise for everyone, because even though the insanity defense rarely works, traditionally it works best in the cases of mothers killing their children. And of mothers killing their children, it works best where mothers kill infants, neonaticide.
Is this dangerous work you do? Dangerous to you?
Yes, which is probably why I will never take the stand in a criminal case again.
Have you had death threats?
I have, and it was not dangerous prior to the intrusion of the cameras in the courtroom. I was not known. My family, my friends, my private patients never knew what I did those days when I was, quote unquote, in court. Mm-hmm. And newspapers really were not terribly interested in these cases, so my name was never in the press. I did not court the press. I tended not to speak to the press. So it was all very tidy and very respectful and very private. The Wernick case, the cameras, the death threats. And death threats to my family and situations in which local police had to be involved and situations in which I felt not only my family and myself, but even my employees were at risk. And I started to say to myself, just how much of a difference do I make in the courtroom that justifies this risk and this danger that I'm taking willingly on myself? But do I have the right to endanger my family, my employees, my patients? And the answer really was no.
What do you do to protect yourself, though? I mean, for instance, did you learn to carry a gun or you learn to use a gun as a way of protecting yourself?
I didn't learn to use a gun as a way of protecting myself specifically. I had been in law enforcement while I was completing my degree in psychology. But there have been occasions where individuals who were indicted for homicide and were subsequently permitted to take an insanity defense without a trial and were later released out into the community made calls to my private office. And there was, I felt, a significant risk because in some of these cases, my opinion alone was responsible for keeping them incarcerated for sometimes a year or so. And so it was clearly attached to me and they knew it. And one of these defendants had killed his common law wife and hacked her body into I don't know how many pieces. So in that situation, I did make sure that I was armed. I did pay special attention to having special ammunition that would not travel and endanger any, you know, innocent bystanders. But it was a consideration.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Barbara Kerwin, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Barbara Kerwin is a forensic psychologist and the author of The Mad, the Bad, and the Innocent. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, police corruption, both real and imagined. We'll talk with New York Daily News writer Mike McAlary, who was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on police corruption. He's written the novelization of the new movie, Copland. Also, we'll remember William Burroughs, who died this weekend at the age of 83. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Copland, the new film starring Harvey Keitel, Robert De Niro, and Sylvester Stallone, opens in mid-August. It's set in a quiet New Jersey town where many of the police officers who work in New York City live. The town sheriff, played by Stallone, discovers a crime and a cover-up committed by these cops and is forced to choose between wanting to protect them and wanting to uphold the law. My guest, Mike McElary, covers crime and law enforcement for the New York Daily News and has written the novelization of the movie Copland. While this is his first piece of fiction, he's had plenty of experience writing about corruption in the New York City police force. His investigation into the 77th Precinct scandal was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize and later became the subject of his book, Buddy Boys. His other books include Cop Shot and Good Cop, Bad Cop. I asked McElary why, as a journalist, he wanted to write a novel based on a movie.
I was the first person to ask that question.
Right. Why me?
Yeah. It's sort of like, I think I was even proud to say to myself that I had never read a novelization. Because it's really ordinarily the bottom rung on the literary food chain. They came to me and asked me to do it and gave me open field to just run mm-hmm. with the story and put flesh on the characters and history and all that is there. It's sort of like I was thinking about this is that Mangold, who wrote a great script.
He's a director and wrote the screenplay for Copland.
He wears two hats, certainly. And it's sort of like he's the songwriter and I'm the singer.
Right.
And so I sang his song.
Well, you know, as I was reading your book, and again, I haven't seen the movie, so mm-hmm. perhaps I'm not sure if I'm reading it in the right sequence mm-hmm. or not. But most of the times, movies are made out of pre-existing books.
Yes.
You read the book, you have this idea in your head about what characters look like, and then you see the film and you say, well, that's not the story that I remember. This sort of plays with that process.
There's
turns
some
it
of that,
upside down.
There's some of that in the book, too. There's some of the stuff, there's some stuff in the book that is different than the movie.
Right.
They allowed me to do that.
Right.
And the other thing that's kind of funny is that once they got the book, they changed the movie. And so now the movie begins with De Niro doing a voiceover of how this town came to be, which goes back to the oldest thing in the world, street reporting,
mm-hmm.
finding
mm-hmm.
out what's right.
Mm-hmm. So you have all those hats that you've had to wear, I guess, came into play here.
You know, everybody I've met, every cop I've met, some fragment of it over the last 10 years is in that book. I mean, there were characters from the 77th Precinct there.
Yeah.
There are, they've been fictionalized, but it's all there. It's as real as my life.
Well, I can't remember if it's in this or whether it's in A Good Cop, Bad Cop. I think it's actually in Copland, where you write, there are no new stories in New York. Most good reporters know. You just have to know which old tales the new story duplicates. And as someone who's covered cops and crime and corruption, is it really the retelling of the same story?
10 years ago, when the 77th Precinct happened in Brooklyn, it was a new kind of police corruption. Serpico and all the cops before him, you had to be sort of in an elite detail to even get the chance to become corrupt, to be tempted. But with the advent of crack, drugs were on every corner. That meant that every patrolman had to make the decision. Am I in or am I out?
And most, they worked with enough independence that they, in a sense, had to make that decision, am I in or out?
Yes, exactly. I mean, in the 77th Precinct case, you look at TV and say, oh, that could never happen. You know, those kind of stories could never happen in real life.
The 77th Precinct case was about?
It was about cops, predominantly white cops, in what was known as sort of the heart of black Brooklyn to the cops, Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights. Which I think everyone knows what Bed-Stuy is. That's and so the cops who lived in the suburbs, these particular cops, they had this occupying army mentality when they came to Brooklyn, and then that was the first mistake. Then they took it one step further, and they decided that they were sort of like garbage men. They would pick guys up. And the next day, the garbage, in fact, I had guys tell me that use those exact words, and they would, the garbage would be back out the next day. Mm-hmm. And there was frustration. And so, although I'm not sure that all these cops who became hooked up in that scandal became cops to become criminals, although there are cops that do that.
Right.
They did some of it out of frustration. But they would drive around to a fire station in that precinct, and every night they worked the midnight tour when no one was watching. They would grab a ladder and tie it to the roof of the car, then scream across the precinct to a place where they knew there were narcotics being sold, crack. And in this one instance, they put the ladder up. They went up through a back window, and the dealers, of course, scattered. The cops are not there to arrest them. And they found all the crack and the money there. And there was a fortified steel door in the front. And as they were preparing to leave, they heard a knock at the door. And so one of the cops went over to the mailbox, and which was sort of high, and looked out. And there was a line of customers formed because this is where they went to buy crack.
Sure.
And so these two cops, the customers couldn't see who was in behind the door. And the cops were there, so they sold the crack to the customers through the door.
So handing the money and the crack back
right,
and forth.
Exchanging. No one saw. All you saw was a pair of hands. Yeah.
And this was all part of your investigation into what was happening in the 77th
right.
Precinct.
Mm-hmm. I was, you know, a cub reporter then. I wasn't a columnist. I hadn't passed the sergeant's test, so to speak. And this guy who was arrested was supposed to surrender in the morning. And he called me up, and Brian O'Regan was his name. And he was one of the cops behind the steel door passing
right.
out the drugs. And here was a guy who was a Marine. He was a war hero. He became a cop to do good, but then he stepped on the line, and then he used to do these like operations. He was the guy that put together all these attacks and assaults on the buildings. And he was so he invited me out to see him, and he told me his whole life story, and it was kind of hairy. I mean, mm-hmm. not kind of hairy, it was hairy.
Was this your first interview with him then?
Yes, yeah. No one had...
Right. But he called you?
Yes.
Did you think in any way you were in danger going to meet him?
No, he had a gun, certainly, but journalism, no matter what you're doing either, it's not a place for cowards or the meek.
So you meet him?
Mm-hmm.
You're sitting down talking with him?
And he tells me his whole story, and... I went with another guy, a friend of mine, Michael Daly, who's a columnist at the News Today Now, too. And he told us his story, and I said, you know, Brian, at one point, Brian, this is going to the paper. You know that, right? And he said, yeah, no, I want it to be in the paper. I want to make things right and for people to understand why it happened. And so I wrote the story, and he didn't show up for his arrest the next day. And,
so the story was in the next day's paper?
Yes. He killed himself.
Yeah.
They found him in a motel later with a copy of the paper there.
So do you think, as you said, that he wanted you to write that obituary, or do you think it was an impulsive thing to do after having kind of confessed his crimes to you?
I'll never know.
Yeah. I mean, and do you feel in any way responsible for him committing suicide, even though he called you?
No, I think that he called me with the idea that the whole thing was planned. I'll get McElary to do the quote-unquote obit,
right.
To get my story, and then right. and then he would kill himself. And it's an incredible weight for these guys, even the corrupt ones. You don't want the guy to kill himself. And 10 years later, I did a book at that time, a couple of years after the suicide, called Buddy Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And the main cop in that story was a cop named Henry Winter. And 10 years to the day that Brian O'Regan killed himself, he killed himself, hung himself in his mother's closet. So cops don't hate reporters so much. Of course, they don't like them. I mean, we're part of the them. In their world, but they can come to trust you if they see that you're responsible and that you're not out for just some cheap story. And the reason the cops talk to me is that you do both sides of the story. And when the cops are heroes, you're there for them and to tell that story. And when they're bad, you're there to tell that story too. Because the cops there's real cops, great cops, and most cops are good. They hate corrupt cops.
Because it taints all of them.
That's right. And when the next time they go to grab someone with a gun and they tell the guy to stop police, maybe the guy won't drop the gun. Maybe because he thinks this cop is corrupt or from part of the Dirty 30 scandal, which was a scandal in Manhattan, he'll shoot the cop. And that happens. And I've seen that happen. Cops, bad cops aren't just bad for the communities they serve. They kill other cops and they get other cops killed.
My guest is Mike McAlary. He covers crime and law enforcement for the New York Daily News. He wrote the novel of the movie Copland, which opens later this month. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to investigative reporter Mike McAlary.
Not all of us get the kind of temptations, I think, that police officers get. We're not dealing with drugs and we're not dealing with cash and all the stuff that can be very tempting to someone who's out on the street. Do you understand, though, what it is to cross the line and how a well-intentioned police officer explains to themselves why it's okay? I mean, this is in part what you've been writing about and investigating.
I think the switch gets flipped. I think that it's a weakness. There are weak cops, there are weak reporters. There are reporters that, you know, will make up quotes, and there are cops that will make up cases. Making up the quotes makes for a better story, and making up the case makes for a better case. So will they do it? Yeah, they'll do it as they think that it's possible to. But it's all weakness, I think.
You also write about, or it's in the novel as well, a sort of tense relationship between law enforcement, between police officers and firefighters. That there's a kind of rivalry there. And I don't know whether this was poetic, you know, you were using some license here, whether you found that in your investigation work as a journalist.
I found that over as long as there's been cops and firemen. There's been that of course, is not in the movie at all. But though, It's really a version of sibling rivalry. In fact, there are, you know, the families where there are firemen, cop, firemen, two against one or one right. against
like
two.
Like the North and the South.
Yeah,
or something.
Exactly. Every family is a civil war. Mm-hmm. But they're in competition, too, for glory.
Mm-hmm.
And the firemen, the cops are, you know, so angry that the firemen dare to call themselves New York's bravest. And the firemen are so angry that the cops dare to call themselves New York finest. What about us? We're fine.
We're brave. We're
fine. We're brave. We're fine. So,
but in a pinch, you know, if cops and firefighters are at the same scene,
it's all gone.
Right.
They are together, and they will do anything to save a life. God forbid a fireman's wife is the victim of some sort of assault. The cops will just, you know, they will put out, you know, every effort into that, and more than just effort to solve that case. And on the other hand, God forbid a policeman's house is on fire.
Did you want to be a cop? Was there a part of you that wanted to do this work? Or do you come from a family of law enforcement people?
No, I don't. But I like to find things out.
Right.
So, in a way, I think investigative reporting, you are a cop. I get up in the morning and go out and trying to find out what happened. I talk to the knock on the same doors and then at the end of the day try and put it together.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite fun. It's really enjoyable to find out something no one else knew, and that, or especially if it's different than what was the public perception.
Right. Is there a lot of work you do literally sitting at your desk, or are you mostly out about in the town?
I tell this to young reporters all the time. you know, get out of the office. There are no stories in the office.
Right.
And
no matter if you're waiting for that phone to ring, you got to get out.
Right. And there should be also, in the column especially, there should be legwork.
Mm-hmm.
The reader should be able to see that you're moving from spot to spot. You're not just sitting in your duff trying to figure out. Sources, people can tell you things, but unless you can go find out what the truth is, the sources could be wrong.
Do you watch NYPD Blue? Do you watch cop shows?
Sure, yeah.
And what do you think about how they do on the air?
Well, NYPD Blue is tremendous. And it's real because the guy who writes it, Bill Clark, I used to cover.
Is that right?
Yeah, he was a cop in Queens. And he was good then, and he's good now. And a lot of the stories are taken right from the front pages. So, and he knows how to make them real because it's his life.
So do you like writing fiction?
Yeah, I do. I mean, eventually, I think that what has to happen as a writer is you can stay in newspapers too long. And the idea is that eventually, I mean, how many fires can he cover? How many murders can he cover? I mean,
kind of like what you said here about the same story told over and over.
And you want to move, you want to sort of like build an exit ramp away from the newspaper. I'll always do a column at least once a week, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. because it keeps you fresh.
Right.
But you should be collecting things as you go along to put in your storage trunk of knowledge. And if you never move on to a novel and see what you have in that trunk, mm-hmm. I think you're a failure. I think you've failed. Yeah.
Is there a certain freedom in writing fiction that's both wonderful and sort of scary at the same time?
It's quite freeing. In fact, with Copland, and as I did the novel later, I got more used to it. You know, you sit there and you write it, and you expect someone to tap you on the shoulder and say, "Hold it just a second. It didn't happen like that. I never said that." It's really quite freeing, and And it's also enjoyable because when you go to think of things, to realize, oh yeah, I can do that. I know that. I know a story like that. I know a story that'll fit here. And there are stories I haven't thought about for years and years that you can draw upon. And
right.
when you go there, they're still there. You can see. You remember how it smelled and the way it tasted. And in the end, a great novelist, I think, is a great reporter. You look at the Plum Island, the stuff that Frank McCourt's book, it's all great. Pete Hamill's book that's out now, it's all great reporting.
And I wonder, too, with journalism, which tends to be terse writing, whether that works for you as a novelist or whether, again, you want to sort of put more flesh on that sort of writing that we associate with reporting.
Yeah, well, the reason that the you know, I didn't want to be when I was a kid, I didn't want to be to be Mickey Mantle. I wanted to be Jimmy Breslin,
right? You know, right.
and Pete Hamill. That's those are the guys I wanted to be. That's right. What I wanted to do.
How come?
Because it just looked like so much fun to cover the world. I mean, Murray Kempton he just recently died, but he was. A friend of mine, and he, you know, you look back at his old columns, and you know, he saw Martin Luther King. He was in the room in Montgomery, and he was, you know, taking notes on the world the whole time. And it's wonderful. It's a great opportunity to get a chance to do that.
Mike McAlary covers crime and law enforcement for the New York Daily News. He wrote the novel of the movie Copland, which opens later this month. Coming up, we remember writer William Burroughs, who died this weekend. This is Fresh Air. Writer William Burroughs died over the weekend. He was 83. Best known for his 1959 book Naked Lunch, he came to the attention of younger generations through his appearances in TV commercials and the accolades offered to him by rock musicians from Steppenwolf to Sonic Youth. In 1995, Rhino Records reissued Burroughs' first recording, a collection of readings entitled Call Me Burroughs. Our rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed the collection. Here's William Burroughs reading from his novel, Naked Lunch.
Drove all night, came at dawn to a warm, misty place, barking dogs and the sound of running water. Thomas and Charlie, I said. What? That's the name of this town. Sea level. We climbed straight up from here 10,000 feet. I took a fix and went to sleep in the back seat. She was a good driver, you can tell as soon as someone touches the wheel. Mexico City, where Lupita sits like an Aztec earth goddess, doling out her little papers of lousy shit. Selling is more of a habit than using, Lupita says. Non-using pushers have a contact habit, and that's one you can't kick. Agents get it, too. Take Bradley, the buyer. Best narcotics agent in the industry. Anyone would make him for junk. I mean, he can walk up to a pusher and score direct. He is so anonymous, gray, and spectral, the pusher don't remember him afterwards. So he twists one after the other. Well, the buyer comes to look more and more like a junkie. He can't drink. He can't get it up. His teeth fall out. He's all the time sucking on a candy bar. Baby Ruth's, he digs special. It really disgusts you to see the buyer sucking on them candy bars so nasty, a cop says. The buyer takes on an ominous gray-green color. Fact is, his body is making its own junk or equivalent. The buyer has a steady connection. A man within, you might say, or so he thinks. I'll just sit in my room, he says. Them all, squares on both sides. I am the only complete man in the industry. But a yen comes on him like a great black wind through the bones. So the buyer hunts up a young junkie and gives him a paper to make it. Oh, all right, the boy says. So what you want to make? I just want to rub up against you and get fixed. Ugh, well, all right, but why can't you just get physical like a human?
When William Burroughs recorded Call Me Burroughs in the mid-60s, he was the pork pie hat of the avant-garde, a button-down man spewing wild stuff, revelatory in its incoherence. He was closely identified with the Beat movement, with Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, but all Burroughs really shared with them was an alienation from straight society and a regular urge to get high. He liked surrealist imagery and borrowed the Dadaist trick of creating some of his texts by cutting up words and phrases from pre-existing prose. But at the same time, Burroughs has always been an all-American writer. One of his shrewdest borrowings is from the hard-boiled detective novels of Raymond Chandler, whose tone of flat malice he captures perfectly in The Fish Poison Con.
I was traveling with Merritt Incorporated, checking store attendants for larceny with a crew of shoppers, and Bob Schaefer, crew leader, who was an American fascist with Roosevelt jokes. It happens in Iowa, this number comes over the car radio. Old Sal got caught in the fence last spring. And Schaefer said, oh, my God, are we ever in Hicksville? Stopped that night in Pleasantville, Iowa, and our tires gave out. We had no tire rations during the war for such a purpose. And Bob got drunk and showed his badge to the locals in a roadhouse by the river. And I ran into the sailor under a potted palm in the lobby. We hit the local croakers with the fish poison kind.
Like the best hard-boiled writers, Burroughs knew that you can imply worlds of emotion if you keep your voice steady while describing terrible things. There's also an element of deadpan comedy in a lot of Burroughs' work. It's what keeps the less attractive aspects of his ideas, his violent misanthropy, his cheap cynicism, from turning too sour.
My trouble began when they decided I was executive timber. It happens like this. A big blonde driller from Dallas picked me out of the labor pool to be his houseboy in a prefabricated bungalow. And in solid. When this friend come down from New York, the driller says, "This is the boy I was telling you about." Friend looks me over chewing his cigar and says, "What are you doing over there with the apes? Why don't you come over here with the board where you belong?" He slips me a long, slimy look. Friend works for the Track News Agency. We don't report the news, we write it. And next thing I know, they have trapped a gray flannel suit on me, and I am sent to this school in Washington to learn how this writing the news before it happens is done. I suss it as the Mayan caper with an IBM machine. I don't want to be caught short in a gray flannel suit when the lid blows off.
William Burroughs recorded in 1965. He died over the weekend at the age of 83. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We'll close with music from David Cronenberg's film, Naked Lunch.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.